You have probably heard it said many times that the only options for quelling the fighting in the Middle East are bad options, certainly from the perspective of the United States. Whether you call it ISIS, ISIL, or Islamic State, that group is a major cause for concern in Syria and Iraq at the moment. That is a part of the world today's guest knows well. Rhys Ehrlich wrote a recent book about Syria. He'll speak in Eugene twice next Wednesday, November 19th, at the U of Oregon Law School and at Tsunami Books. He's on the phone with us now. Rhys Ehrlich is a well-traveled reporter with many awards to show for his efforts, including a Peabody for his work on a documentary on Asians in America. He even got a Rhys Ehrlich Day in San Francisco in September of 2010, recognized by city supervisors for his work as an investigative journalist. Rhys Ehrlich's books include Conversations with Terrorists, Target Iraq, and the recently released Inside Syria. Rhys Ehrlich, thanks for joining us on the Jefferson Exchange today.
Good morning. My pleasure.
I understand you just returned recently from Syria. Is that right?
Well, I recently returned from the region. I was reporting from the Iraqi Kurdistan and northern Iraq in August, just a few days after the U.S. bombing started, yes.
And how dangerous a region is it? I mean, how easy was it or not for you to be able to move around and feel like you had some sense of safety and security?
Well, it got increasingly dangerous as my trip approached. I wasn't planning on a dangerous trip. Whenever you have bombing, you have the potential danger. The ISIS was shelling different cities in the region at the time. But I didn't intentionally go out to the war-torn areas. I went and interviewed Yazidi refugees and Christian refugees and others who had been fleeing the fighting.
The Yazidis were among the religious minorities, more than an ethnic minority, I guess, but that were
They're
under...
Both, actually.
Okay, and they were under siege by Islamic State. In fact, which terminology do you prefer, Islamic State, ISIS?
Well, I currently use the Islamic State simply because that's what they call themselves, but people refer to ISIS or ISIL, it's all the same thing.
Mm-hmm. All right, and the Yazidis in particular were targeted. Why? I mean, is the Islamic State folks just against anybody who is not Islamic?
Well, it's a bit more complicated than that. It's a question of political power. I think people think, oh, these are religious extremists and something in Islam tells them to go kill people and so on. That's not a correct view. They are after political and economic power. They use religion as the excuse to attack people, and they know that the Yazidis, the Christians, the Shia Muslims, and some Sunni Muslims will never agree to be ruled by them. So they're basically killing off some and scaring the rest to leave. It's a process of ethnic cleansing. And that includes some Sunni Muslims who don't agree politically with this ultra-right-wing policies that they're trying to impose on both Syria and Iraq.
So it sounds like they're not purely one strain of Islam, or am I reading that incorrectly?
Well, they try to draw their strength from Sunni Islam. And if you listen to their rhetoric, they claim to be the inheritors of the Prophet Muhammad, and they're setting up a caliphate like used to exist hundreds of years ago, blah, 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 blah. But it has nothing to do with actual Islam, which is a religion of peace. But they try to draw their support from Sunni Muslims.
And you say that Sunnis, Shiites, and a lot of other people would not ever want to be ruled by them because of the kind of government they're espousing? Or
yeah, they're so extreme that they've been denounced by Al-Qaeda. That ought to tell you something. They in turn, consider Al-Qaeda to be a bunch of wusses and too liberal. Basically, they claim that they have set up an Islamic caliphate. They're no longer a rebel group, but they're an actual governing body. And they've imposed extremist measures in all the cities that they've taken over, ransacking churches, killing people and beheading people in public that don't agree with them. We've seen, of course, the beheadings by of the American journalists and aid workers, but they do this on a regular basis for political opponents in cities they take over. And it's generating a lot of discontent. There's already been some rebellions among Sunni tribal groups in Syria. It's a very unstable form of government, although quite repressive.
Were you there when the journalists were beheaded?
No, I was back in the U.S. by that time. Remember, it took place after the U.S. started the bombing.
Right.
And it was the Islamic State's perverted criminal way of trying to warn the U.S. Against what it was doing.
The actions certainly seem deliberate in the sense of wanting to inflame opinion. I mean, getting people essentially where they really live. It's like a beheading is such a heinous act that it's almost like they're daring the United States to come bomb them, is the way some people view that. How do you view
that? Well, again, remember the U.S. had started the bombing first. Oh, right. This is their retaliation for it. From their perspective, as horrible as it is, they think they're retaliating for the bombing that the U.S. started, and that this will somehow intimidate the U.S. or show that there's consequences for the U.S. actions. But they're criminal activity. And the problem, of course, as horrific as these beheadings were, and I think it's what provoked U.S. public opinion to finally support military action in Syria, as horrible as it is, there is no more danger from Islamic State to people in the United States than there was from Al-Qaeda or other similar isolated terrorist groups. The U.S. used the anger at the beheadings to justify a new war.
All right, we'll pick it up on the other side of a break. Reese Ehrlich is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, well-traveled independent reporter, knows Syria very well. We'll talk more about Syria and Iraq and Islamic State. With you, a reminder, too, that Reese Ehrlich will appear in Eugene at 12:30 next Wednesday at the U of O Law School in room 175. That's on Agate Street in Eugene. And later at 7 o'clock at Tsunami Books in Eugene, sponsored by CALC, the Community Alliance of Lane County. He'll be back here on the Jefferson Exchange with your phone calls and emails in a minute 10. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is Reese Ehrlich, an independent journalist who has worked in many different media and writes books as well, has spent a lot of time in the Middle East, and his most recent book is called Inside Syria. So he's blessed with a lot of knowledge about the region, perhaps cursed with it as well. We'll have to ask about that. But you can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about the events in the Middle East and Islamic State and the establishment of this caliphate at 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, 800-838-3760. Our email address is jx@jeffnet.org. And we look forward to hearing from you. Reese Ehrlich, I have to ask about what you just said, though, about you don't see any more danger coming from Islamic State than from Al-Qaeda or anyone else to the United States.
Yes.
In the sense that they're not going to engender terrorist attacks on American soil?
Yeah, exactly. The key thing is what the Islamic State is doing in Syria and Iraq is horrific for the people of that region. There's no question about it. But so is the Boko Haram in Nigeria. And there's lots of these terrorist groups running around in Somalia and elsewhere. And every time there's a human rights attack, it's not the United States' job to go in and militarily occupy the country, which is what we're doing once again in Iraq. The question is, the Islamic State, and this is even admitted by the Obama administration, the Islamic State doesn't have sleeper cells, it doesn't have agents, it doesn't have people that it's directing to carry out terrorist attacks. And the Obama administration has admitted that, and they claim that there's some new group unaffiliated with the Islamic State that is called the Khorasan, and that they're the real ones that we've bombed. And there's significant indications that the group doesn't even exist. I mean, the administration is flailing around to try to find some connection to get people in the United States worried when it doesn't exist.
Is the reason for that, as you see it, to make sure that there can be public support for campaigns against militants?
Exactly. I mean, we have some history with this in the case of the run-up to the Iraq War in 2003, where, remember, the weapons of mass destruction that didn't exist, the terrorist threat that didn't exist, both Republican and Democratic administrations have a habit of deciding to go to war and then coming up with reasons later. And we've now had at least four different sets of reasons to go to war in Iraq and Syria, none of which hold up to any kind of scrutiny.
Let us take a phone call. We have Mark in Reading on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Reese Ehrlich, the independent journalist. We're talking about Iraq and Syria.
Good morning. I understand that in the early days of the ISIS, that members of the Saudi royal family were giving them money. The Saudi royal family also happens to be at least partial owner of the arms supplier known as the Carlyle Group, and I'm wondering if they're making a good profit on this.
All right, thanks for the question,
it's
Mark.
It's a good question. I actually did some reporting from Saudi Arabia for Global Post, and I detailed how the Saudi government and wealthy individuals in Saudi Arabia were backing the al-Nusra Front, which was the al-Qaeda affiliate, still is, and at that time was ISIS was part of that. So your caller is spot on. The Saudis, of course, they denied it, and they continue to deny it. And the irony is that the U.S. has announced plans, since we don't have any other allies on the ground in Syria, the U.S. is going to train so-called moderate rebels, send them to Saudi Arabia, and then reintroduce them back into Syria. And the Saudis are far from promoting moderation. It's like sending police cadets from Chicago to be trained by Al Capone. I mean, it ain't going to work.
Well, and the whole idea of training and arming rebels anyway apparently runs afoul of American law, because I was just reading this morning.
Oh, you're such a stickler.
Oh, yeah, I know. Well, I mean, what can I say?
American law, please.
Well, the
American law is whatever we say it is.
Well, but there are discussions in the Senate, I should point out, that they're trying not to run afoul of the laws that say you can't arm extremist groups who are using terrorist tactics. And Pat Leahy and other members of the Senate are saying, you know, we've got an issue here.
And they're quite right, and not to mention the fact that there's an issue that the president unilaterally declared war once again with no debate in Congress. And he's using the justification that of the 9/11 resolutions that were passed to go after al-Qaeda. Well, Islamic State is not part of al-Qaeda. They hate it. They're fighting each other. So when it comes to legality, there's nothing that the administration has put forward that makes any sense. It's all realpolitik.
And again, the terminology getting used, we have another acronym, of course, AUMF, the Authorization for the Use of Military Force, which is the one that was, again, post 9/11, still considered in effect today, certainly by the White House.
Sure, but that was to go after the people responsible for 9/11. Islamic State didn't even exist. I mean, you have to stretch things to unrecognizable lengths to try to come up with a legal argument.
So let's walk backward then to the genesis of Islamic State. Where did this group come from? I mean, is this remnants of the old Iraqi army that was disbanded by the American occupation force?
Not quite, although some of those people, some of the military officers have migrated to the Islamic State in subsequent years. No, it didn't exist, and indeed no Islamic terrorist group existed in Iraq prior to 2003. They had all been repressed by Saddam Hussein, who was a brutal dictator. When the U.S. invaded in 2003, all kinds of rebel groups grew up among Shia Muslims, among Sunnis, among different ethnic and political groups, one of which was a group called Al-Qaeda in Iraq, or Al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia. And your listeners may remember in 2007, 2008, there was the surge by the U.S. troops. Well, that was designed to go after that extremist group, which was a predecessor for today's Islamic State. They were defeated militarily mainly because the Sunnis in Iraq were so disgusted with their extremist views and practices. And they were defeated militarily, but not politically. They later migrated across the border into Syria when the uprising there began in 2011, and they managed to pick up some support from particularly Saudi Arabia and some of the other conservative Gulf states. And that's the origins of it. The U.S. created the conditions for the growth of the Islamic State. They didn't create the group itself, of course, but they created the conditions.
They took the lid off the Middle East, in essence, and let everything fester.
And all of this was knowable ahead of time. This isn't like some tragic mistake or unforeseen consequences. I wrote a book called Target Iraq, and it came out before the war began, in which we accurately described the mess that was going to result from the U.S. Occupation of Iraq.
What do you suppose, and here again we come back to the person of Dick Cheney, vice president at the time that the invasion of Iraq took place. Dick Cheney as defense secretary after Iraq had been driven out of Kuwait by George Bush Sr., said you don't want to go into Baghdad because that's a bad situation. You'd have to control the whole situation yourself. What other than 9/11 and fears of further terrorist attacks, or maybe that was enough, was the huge difference in an approach from one so central figure?
Yeah, well, I think what happened was the neoconservative viewpoint came to dominate in the second Bush administration, the son, right, George W. And they genuinely believed that they could conquer Iraq, and that was just the first step to going on then to Iran, to Lebanon, to Syria, that the U.S. ultra-conservative version of what a peaceful Middle East would look like could be imposed through a combination of military and covert military kinds of actions. And they openly criticize what not just Dick Cheney, but Colin Powell and George Bush Sr. and everybody had said at the time, which was, if you depose Saddam Hussein, you're going to have chaos in Iraq. And in fact, that's what turned out to happen. So they changed their mind based on ideological perceptions that turned out to be completely wrong.
Reese Ehrlich is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. He's an independent journalist who has won many awards for his efforts, even got a Reese Ehrlich Day in San Francisco in September of 2010, written several books, his most recent one called Inside Syria. We're talking about Syria and Iraq. He'll be in Eugene for a couple of speaking engagements next Wednesday, one at the U of O Law School at 12:30, at Tsunami Books at 7. You can join him right here, right now on The Exchange as we talk about what's going on in the Middle East and what the options might be. 800-838-3760 around the region, 800-838-3760, or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. So here again, Islamic State grew out of the remnants of al-Qaeda in Iraq. A couple of things I need to know about here. When they crossed the border to Syria, they obviously were looking for people they could connect with. But what is the advantage to Saudi Arabia for arming or at least assisting a group like this?
Well, Saudi Arabia doesn't believe in democratic elections or any of the other kind of civil society institutions that go along with a non-monarchy, a non-dictatorship. They've always backed either other monarchies or brutal military dictatorships like the current one in Egypt, just as one example. And so they rejected any kind of centrist or conservative rebel groups that might favor those things. So, and there was a natural ideological and religious affiliation that they felt with the more extremist groups who shared their ultra-right-wing interpretation of Islam. So that was the main reason. And then in addition to that, the ultra-conservative groups in Syria seemed to be making the most headway against Assad, and they were picking a winner. So everybody, including the U.S., was flailing around to find somebody who could actually win the war against Assad. And for a time, they were backing the Nusra Front, and now they back other groups that they claim are moderates, but are frankly politically just as bad as the Nusra Front.
This would seem to imply, actually more than imply, that the folks in Saudi Arabia don't really care what tactics are used as long as there's a religious or ideological lining up, an alignment there.
Yep, and it's very similar to the U.S., which is that we claim that we're backing moderates. The problem was we couldn't find anybody who was both pro-U.S. and willing to... they had any kind of base on the ground. So that means the U.S. is flailing around as well. Just as a small example, and your listeners have probably heard of Kobani, this city in northern Iraq that's mostly Kurdish.
Very close to Turkey.
Turkey, yeah. And there's been fierce fighting there. Well, the people doing the most fierce fighting are from a group that's affiliated with the PKK, or the Kurdistan Workers' Party. That's a group the U.S. considers to be terrorists. And the U.S. is now providing arms and ammunition to a group that it considers terrorists. So the U.S. is flailing around to find a policy that might work.
In Kobani in particular, don't we have a situation where you have Kurds fighting other Kurds?
No, not in Kobani, actually.
Okay.
They're fighting the Islamic State, and they're putting up some pretty stiff resistance, and that's a good thing. No, actually what happened is the Turks allowed in some fighters from other Kurdish factions to come into Kobani as a way to kind of cover over the fact that they were allowing the arms and supplies to get in, which they had previously blocked.
So
they're all cooperating in Kobani.
So it sounds like the situation you get, Reese, is that it becomes an extreme example of the enemy of my enemy is my friend, but the calculus changes just a few miles away, it sounds like.
Yeah, exactly. Or the enemy of my enemy is my friend. The enemy of my enemy is my friend this week, because it keeps shifting. Remember, it was only a little over a year ago that the U.S. was going to bomb Assad for the chemical weapons issue. Remember that one?
I do.
And now we're bombing Assad's worst enemies and helping Assad. And it makes no sense. And in fact, it's angered both Turkey and some of the rebel groups that the U.S. had formerly been allied with. So the Free Syrian Army, which everyone has heard of and was promoted as the moderate group. A couple of weeks ago, the Pentagon announced they weren't going to fund the Free Syrian Army anymore because they wouldn't focus their attention on attacking the Islamic State. They wanted to focus on Assad. So even the enemy of my enemy thing doesn't work. It's the politics are extremely complicated, and the U.S. continues to make bad choices.
Was it a bad choice to not take some sort of military action after the discovery of the use of chemical weapons? I mean, the whole line drawn in the sand thing. There's lots of criticism at the time about the president not moving.
Yeah, the tricky thing about that is, and in my book, I have a whole chapter on the chemical weapons issue. It's quite likely that one of the extremist rebel groups was actually responsible for the use of the chemical weapons earlier in March. The one in August may well have been the Assad government. But the fact that somebody ostensibly on the same side as the United States, or at least opposed to Assad, used the chemical weapons, and if the U.S. had started bombing then, can you imagine the uproar when the truth came out? So I think it wasn't a question of Obama vacillating or he should have bombed earlier or something. Because it would have been exposed that the Nusra Front had probably used some of the early chemical weapons. By the time of August, with the big attacks, the Assad government may well have been responsible, there was no popular support for it. The U.S. tried. They did all the tried and true. Oh, my God, there's chemical weapons. There's another crisis. We have to do something. Humanitarian crisis number 118. And lo and behold, the public wouldn't go for it. And he didn't dare bring it to a vote in Congress because he would have lost. And the British Parliament voted against it anyway. So it was a big defeat in which suddenly this Hail Mary pass to eliminate chemical weapons, which has indeed been carried out, was a fortunate but unplanned move by the administration.
That truly was John Kerry off the cuff. It really was not something
planned. Oh, yeah. Well, the Russians had talked to the U.S. about doing this before, but the U.S. had ignored it, saying, oh, you know, the usual, we can't trust Assad. How do we know he's going to really do it, blah, blah. But the U.S. was so desperate by that point to do something that they said, okay, we'll give it a try. And lo and behold, Assad did indeed get rid of his chemical weapons.
Reese Ehrlich is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange, a well-traveled and a longtime reporter for a number of different news services and a number of different media. He's also the author of a book, Inside Syria, The Backstory of Their Civil War and What the World Can Expect. So the players in Syria, I saw an unbelievable number just recently about the number of rebel groups at work in Syria. What is the number you know to be?
Somewhere around 1,500, the last count.
Okay, that squares with what I saw, too. That's an amazing number. So how do you know even, I mean, and are they all colors of the rainbow, essentially, in different stripes of ardor for knocking off Assad or hatred of some other group?
Yeah, how do you keep track of group 1,432 versus 1,296, right?
Right?
No, what it is that some of these groups are no more than a few handfuls of friends from the same village or the same neighborhood in the city who've gotten together, and then they ally with some bigger group that allies with some bigger group, and the coalitions and the alliances are constantly fragmenting and reuniting and so on. So there are a few major trends among the rebels, but the fact that there's so many groups and they have so many different, the only thing they can agree on is getting rid of Assad. But there's a lot of disagreement as to what kind of country and society they'd like to see afterwards. But that's what makes it so difficult, because Assad only controls about a third of the country. The rebels control two-thirds, but they're so fragmented they can't present a united effort against Assad.
So it ends up farther away from Assad. It's rebel against rebel. Is that often what's going on?
Yeah, in some cases, and particularly the Islamic State, which doesn't consider itself an actual rebel group. They consider themselves a functioning state. That's why they call themselves the Islamic State. And basically, they kill and blow up any rebel group that won't join them. So it's extreme sectarianism and causes a great deal of anger among the other rebel groups.
Are there any central figures? I mean, obviously one of the functions of a dictatorship is to make sure that other central figures don't come to oppose you. So, I mean, is there anybody around whom Syrians might rally as a single person who would be the bold leader? I imagine Assad probably had somebody like that killed a long time ago.
Or they went into exile. The U.S. has tried to come up with various former military folks from the Syrian army, that none of which have so far fit the bill of being both pro-U.S. and being having any kind of popular support. I think, well, after the break, we can talk some more about what kind of future coalition might actually emerge in Syria.
All right. Thanks for noticing the music. I appreciate that. Reese Ehrlich is our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Globetrotting journalist, has spent a lot of time in the Middle East, particularly in Syria. He'll be appearing in Eugene twice next Wednesday at the U of O Law School at 12:30 and at 7 o'clock at Tsunami Books. His talk at the U of O Law School is called Beyond the Spin on Syria. Is the U.S. military helping or hurting the effort to stop ISIS? So we'll certainly make that a central topic of the next segment here on the Jefferson Exchange. Back with your phone calls and emails for Reese Ehrlich in a minute 15. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest today is the well-traveled journalist Reese Ehrlich, who has spent a lot of time in the Middle East. His most recent book is Inside Syria. Before that, he wrote Target Iraq and Conversations with Terrorists. He'll be speaking in Eugene at a couple of appointments on Wednesday of next week. And he's here now with us on the Jefferson Exchange to bring to bear his expertise on Iraq and Syria and Islamic State. Join us on the exchange at 800-838-3760. Questions, comments, welcome at 800-838-3760 or send emails to jx@jeffnet.org. We're just talking about any coalition that might form out of the 1,500 different rebel groups fighting Bashar Assad in Syria. I mean, here again, are there alliances that form and then unform and then reform later on?
Yeah, that's exactly what happens. And some of the groups that I interviewed took on militant-sounding Islamic names in order to get funding from donors in the Gulf, and they go on YouTube and they carry out an action and make sure that it's filmed, and then they can, it's kind of like application process, you know, to get funding like you would do for a nonprofit here or something. It's a bizarre process, and so but the funders want to know that these groups are actually doing something, so they post their stuff on YouTube. But I think there is the potential, particularly if Assad is no longer in power, for some of the people from his regime that don't have blood on their hands, the non-extremist rebels and the civil society activists, could form a coalition that would have some stability and lay the groundwork for future development in Syria. That is a possibility.
The title of your talk next Wednesday at 12:30, the University of Oregon Law School, is Beyond the Spin on Syria, Is the U.S. Military Helping or Hurting the Effort to Stop ISIS? Let me drop back even further from the military. Is the United States' interest in the region, just the fact that it's paying attention to this, any sort of a disruption to what might be an easier process without us?
Well, there's no question that the U.S. Policies in the region have been very disruptive in recent years, and it's not about human rights. It's not about protecting people from the Islamic State. It's about oil, military bases, and geopolitics. Iraq is the third largest oil reserves in the world. The Kurdish region in the north by itself has the ninth largest, according to Kurdish officials. And, of course, neighboring Iran has number two, and Saudi Arabia is number one. So long term, the U.S. wants oil supplies for its industry and for its uses and control of the international oil markets, and to deny use of the oil in the region to its enemies, whoever they might be. In this case, right now, it's China and Russia and Iran. That's at the core of what the long-term goals are. And the U.S. military bases were closed after the end of 2011 under the terms of the treaty signed by George Bush. And the U.S. would like to see a pro-government, pro-U.S. government in Baghdad and Damascus and even Tehran, if it could. And those are the long-term strategic goals, and they come up with immediate reasons of protecting people or whatever as the way to win popular support.
With the oil itself, I understand that the Islamic State is actually able to sell oil off and fund its services with that. Is that how
yes,
extensive is
that? Yes, although the amount of money that it's making is wildly exaggerated. There's been, the Pentagon at one point claimed $1 million a day in oil revenues. And when asked how they could possibly calculate that number, that's $365 million a year. What they did was they took what the previous oil production had been and multiplied it by the amount of the price of oil on the international market. and came up with some bizarre figure. Well, first of all, the wells are not producing like they used to. And secondly, they can't sell their oil at international prices because it's illegal, and they get maybe 20 or 30 cents on the dollar for their oil. So yes, the Islamic State is, what they're doing is they're loading a certain amount of crude into tanker trucks, and then they're sold to middlemen who sell it to other middlemen, and it ends up mostly in Turkey or other neighboring countries. And they are making some money off of it, but it's a very, it's a cottage industry. It's not serious oil production.
From what you know of the situation there then, Reese, I mean, is Islamic State as frightening as it certainly wants to be perceived? Is it as powerful as it is seen to be? Why, for example, do we have members of the Iraqi army not only retreating but leaving their uniforms behind?
Right. Well, the it's a political question, not mainly a military one, because they had relatively few fighters involved in those attacks on Mosul and certainly in Syria. The political situation in Iraq was so bad that the Sunnis felt so alienated from the government of al-Maliki that they saw the Islamic State as a political, a viable political alternative, as horrible as they are. And that same with the Iraqi army. The Iraqi army was corrupt and sectarian. It was split along Sunni-Shia lines and Kurdish lines. It wasn't a unified national army. And when the Islamic State and the local Sunnis rose up against the army, they fled because they knew they couldn't possibly win. But in the long run, as I mentioned before, or even in the medium term, Islamic State's governing policies are so horrific that the tide will turn against them politically, and that's what will lead to their military defeat.
Well, let's take a call. We have Wolfgang in Sunny Valley on the line. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Reese Ehrlich.
Good morning. It's a fascinating subject. It's fascinating wherever it happens on the globe. And there's one white elephant in the room. And let me pose that white elephant in a question. Are any of these groups led by women? And obviously the answer is no.
Well, and, the question is, are they led by a woman, or do they have women's participation?
Led, originating.
No, mm-hmm. Yeah, none are led by women.
Exactly. Okay. So, now, are any of these issues, and I'm glad you brought that up, you sort of elaborated on it, are any of the issues involved fundamentally not about stuff, not about control of resources?
All right, good questions. Thanks for those, Wolfgang.
At the core of the fight is over natural resources, political and economic power. But people on all sides use religion as the justification. And the treatment of women, of course, is incorporated. And if you're an ultra-conservative Christian or Jew or Muslim, you're going to deny women their rights. Ironically, the one group in the area that has significant participation by women, including women commanders and fighters, is the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers Party, which the U.S. and Turkey consider to be a terrorist group. It's the one secular group where women actually have some kind of participation. And by the way, I quickly add that in my book, I describe the history of the PKK, and I'm no fan of them, nor are they some kind of liberation group. But the U.S. Mischaracterizes them intentionally for various reasons. So if you listen to the Islamic State rhetoric, they claim to be fighting to reestablish Islamic values and so on. But in reality, it's about imposing a new dictatorship.
So just their dictator, as
yeah,
opposed to
exactly.
The old dictator.
You got it. That's exactly right.
Huh. Is it just that democracy is unknown in that part of the world, or the concept of freedom as we understand it?
This is where it gets tricky, because the U.S. defines democracy in a particular way. It means free elections and free markets. And most people in the Arab world are fine with the first and have some questions about the second, and particularly when those free markets mean U.S. oil companies come in and take over your oil resources or other U.S. companies take over. There are relatively stable countries in the region that have had elections, that have civil society norms. So, for example, Lebanon at various times, Tunisia today. Would I call them democracy? No, but I don't consider any country, including Israel in the region, as a democracy. So there are countries that are relatively better off and freer compared to others. And Tunisia offers actually a very good example. They just recently had elections. The conservative Islamist party lost. They peacefully gave up power. A new coalition that includes leftists and progressives and some elements from the old regime got the plurality. Trade unions and women's groups and student and professional societies are all quite strong and putting pressure on for social change. So it's the Arab Spring, where it began, is showing positive signs in Tunisia.
But then back in places like Iraq, you mentioned Nouri al-Maliki, who was in power for so long as prime minister there, and he really ran it as a Shiite state. And so this really gave birth to a lot of the resentment among the Sunnis, yes?
Oh, absolutely. And remember, Nouri al-Maliki was handpicked by the United States as a prime minister. He was a little-known politician, Zalman Khalilzai, the U.S. ambassador to Iraq, literally picked him out of a bunch of possible prime ministers. They installed him in power. He seemed to be carrying out the U.S. policies for a while, but actually the government in Baghdad ended up being more friendly to Iran than to the United States, and they imposed, as you said, they arrested or tried to arrest some of the top Sunni leaders for corruption, but didn't go after their own guys for corruption. And the net result was alienated both the Kurds and the Sunnis, as significant minorities in Iraq.
So then you have this Sunni backlash, which coalesces. And so to make clear again, Islamic State is generally Sunni, or is not even?
It's Sunni. Right. They draw their support from Sunnis, yes.
All right. Now you mentioned earlier that Islamic State and al-Qaeda hate each other. There have been reports in the last day or so about some agreement, some mysterious, we started at midnight, we ended at 4 in the morning, chat between al-Qaeda's leaders and Islamic State, and that they've agreed to work together. What do you hear about that, and what do you think the possibilities are for that to be a long-term thing?
We'll see. I always take those kind of reports with a grain of salt, because who are your sources and how reliable are they? I mean, on the one hand, ideologically, they have a lot in common. Of course, we're all part of one organization to begin with. But the level of antagonism has been pretty fierce lately. And I'm going to wait and see. I'm skeptical about whether they'll be able to reunite.
What is the source of the antagonism? I mean, as you point out, some of their goals are certainly similar and their tactics certainly similar. But are there some ideological core values that are different?
Yeah, there's strategic differences. The Islamic State considers itself an actual caliphate, an actual government, which means they tolerate no participation by any other rebel group, let alone, of course, Assad. So if you're the Nusra Front and you want to participate in running the city, for example, that's been freed from Assad, the Islamic State's going to come after you and kill you, because you're not the Islamic State. That's one huge difference. Basically, the Nusra Front doesn't believe that you can create the Islamic State now. That's a distant goal, and that you have to have more cooperation with other rebel groups, although they're highly sectarian themselves. So there are quite significant differences, and we'll see if they're able to overcome them.
When we talk about the American involvement in the region, certainly as presented to any leaders in America, the general phrase is all the options are bad. And do you see any that are less bad that might be pursued by the United States? Or is the United States better off dropping back and letting things happen as they will?
Well, that is a distinct option, which is I'm an advocate of non-intervention. I think the U.S. should stop its military bombing. It should stop its arming of groups. It should politically and diplomatically go to Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and others, and get them to do the same thing, because they're arming groups favorable to them, and then go to Russia and Iran and Hezbollah and say, look, you're intervening on the other side. We've lessened or stopped our intervention. Now it's time for you to do the same and let people negotiate a settlement on their own without outside interference. And as naive as that might sound to some people, it's a whole lot better than reoccupying Iraq, blowing up the country again, and costing $5 billion plus a year that may mount into the trillions eventually, like the last wars did. We can't afford it militarily, politically, or economically.
Do you see the potential for some opportunism here if Assad began to look a little shakier, that the United States might help out somebody to finish him off?
Oh, yeah, I think so. At the moment, the U.S. obviously has not strategically changed its opinion of Assad. They've tactically pivoted because they think the Islamic State is worse. So, yes, if the U.S. had a chance to assassinate Assad or otherwise attack him, sure, they would if they thought they could get away with it.
So, I mean, we're talking years then, you think, for anything to work out to something?
Yeah, well, Obama is already saying it's going to take years. I mean, he's not even trying to paint some optimistic picture of settling this. The problem is the U.S. bombing can't win the war. Everyone agrees to that. Who exactly on the ground is going to take over the cities of Mosul or Kirkuk or some other cities that might be or are captured by the Islamic State? And the answer is, the pressure will be for U.S. to reintroduce its own troops.
We will see what happens. Reese Ehrlich is a longtime reporter studying the Middle East at length. His talk, Beyond the Spin on Syria, is the U.S. military helping or hurting the effort to stop ISIS, will be next Wednesday, November 19th at 12:30 at the University of Oregon Law School, room 175. That evening at 7 o'clock at Tsunami Books. Reese Ehrlich, thanks so much for joining us today on the Jefferson
Exchange.
Thank
you for having me on the show.
You bet. Take care. That'll do it for today's Exchange. Check us out online at jeffexchange.org and on our Facebook page. The Exchange is produced by Charlotte Dern of JPR News. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Please join us again next time and have a great weekend.